Welcome to Elgin Movie Watchers Podcast, and we're going to have a fabulous episode this week. I'm Chuck Zlatkin, and I'm here with my co-hosts, Steve Gould and Ian Zlatkin. How you doing, guys?
Good, good, good.
Doing well.
So we're going to tease our listeners with some directors, some great, maybe in their opinion, not so great, some that are well-known, some that are not well-known, and some of the issues that directors have to deal with. So I think it should be a very inspiring podcast.
Yes, and we'll call it Directors Part One.
Okay.
Of who knows how many parts, but we're not going to cover it all tonight on this episode.
No.
So I'll just begin with a little anecdote.
Okay.
About one of the world's best known, and I guess some people would say maybe best directors, and that's Alfred Hitchcock. I mean, he was a very well-known director because of Rear Window and Vertigo. When he got this idea that he wanted to adapt Robert Bloch's novel Psycho to the screen, he had no interest from any studios at all, but he believed so much in it. But he also felt, because the twist in the story was so mind-blowing, that he felt that it would be a hit, but he wanted to, you know, stay in total control. So what he ended up doing was remortgaging his house to finance it himself, and he shot it in black and white, basically to keep the cost down. And also, in his mind, to ensure that the ending would be a surprise, when he gave out the scripts to the actors, it didn't include the final pages. They didn't see the final 10 pages until they were starting the day of filming. And also, he went around and bought up all the copies he could of the novel. He didn't want anybody to know what the ending of it was. And
man, he'd be screwed by social media now, wouldn't he?
Oh, yeah. But he was right, though, because the ending of that film is considered, you know, one of the classic moments.
That was released, what, 65 or Universal, I think.
Yes, Universal. 65 was also the year that A Thousand Clowns was.
It was 60. Uh-oh. 60. Psycho was released in 60.
No, 60. Okay.
Yeah. And
it gave birth to A Thousand Clowns. That's what happened.
That's right. Yeah.
Only been inspired by it to pick A Thousand Clowns.
On your list of great directors, you don't have Fred Coe listed there, I would assume.
Yeah.
Me? No. No.
Well, it was an asterisk on the list. That's what it was. I will add, because of you bringing up Hitchcock, that in the Washington Post this Sunday, I saw this thing and I said, what the hell is that doing here? And they were doing these things about data. And one of the things that came up was directors and films that appear most often on college syllabuses. And guess what director appears the most in college syllabuses? Your buddy Alfred. So Hitchcock appears, at least from their data entry, like 2,200 times in college syllabuses, whereas some of the other ones are half of that, like Orson Welles, Stanley Kubrick, Kurosawa, Spielberg. So I thought that was pretty amazing. But I mean, well, Ian, I know you, when you were at Hunter, what was the story? Was that... did they use a lot of Hitchcock to talk about directing?
It's funny because in my early years, like I, you know, studied at Hunter for film and media studies, when I took the, you know, basically the anatomy of a scene class, it was all Citizen Kane. And it was a Citizen Kane class, and that's all it was. And it was basically Orson Welles all the time. I took that course, and I think the next year, after like 30 years, they decided to change the movie, and they did Rear Window. They did Hitchcock's Rear Window.
Wow.
And that was they broke down that movie for a whole semester. And it makes it a lot more fun, because that's a much more fun film than, say, Citizen Kane, to watch over and over and over and over again. Hitchcock wasn't necessarily, I think maybe I did see Rear Window. I mean, I had already seen it, but they showed it in my, I had like a New York film class. So it was only movies about New York, made in New York, you know, stuff like that. So I saw that in there. But yeah, it was definitely what Citizen Kane and Orson Welles was pushed much more back then than Hitchcock, maybe.
Well, you know, funny you mention about Welles, because I like watching once in a while. I always enjoyed how he interviewed people. And Dick Cavett, I guess it was a couple of nights ago, they had a rerun of his interview with Orson Welles. And it was just unbelievably good. I mean, Cavett and him really hit it off. They were very, very amusing. Welles told, and this is something that Chuck was bringing up about financing, Welles was always looking for funding. And he had a fish on the line. He was in Venice, staying at a hotel on the Lido. He had this guy, I don't know, Armenian or something, but a financier. And also there was somebody that he had worked with during WW2, and that was Winston Churchill, who remembered him. And when he came in with this financier, Churchill kind of like smiled and nodded to him. And it really impressed the financier that, you know, Churchill knew Welles. So Welles is out like a beach whale swimming in a lagoon there in Venice. And who's next to him but Winston? And he tells how nice it was that he did that because of the financing and all of this stuff. And then as it happened the next night or so, Welles is going into the dining room of the hotel again in Venice. And who's sitting at a table as they're coming in? And Winston Churchill. And all of a sudden, when they're coming in, Winston Churchill stands up and bows to Orson Welles, and he got the money immediately from this guy. So you never know. But it's a really good story. And Welles also mentioned in there that if there was one movie that he would save amongst all the movies, it was a Jean Renoir film called Grand Illusion.
Oh, yeah.
And that's, you know, that's a film that played at the Elgin many times.
Best anti-war film ever made.
Yeah. And it also was a film that was on the shit list with Germany. So, and I just wanted to bring up, since you mentioned a little anecdote about a director, somebody that everybody knew as a kid, you know, in our generation, Chuck, and that was Ronnie Howard, now Ron Howard, as Opie. And he got a break, and probably Ian, knew about this with his film classes. But Roger Corman gave Ron Howard his first break. He let him direct a movie called Grand Theft Auto, which, you know, did pretty good business. But the reason I'm bringing up Ron Howard was when I was working for Translux, we got to go out. I think it was Translux, maybe Crown or Paramount, I don't know. But one of the places I worked, and I got a junket to go out to LA. And they do those things where, you know, they give you a movie to look at and then snacks and drinks afterward to try to get theater owners to play the movies. And we were at Balboa Beach and we saw this movie at the movie theater there. And then we're out at this pool and the movie was Splash. Now, I don't know if either of you guys saw it, but it was a movie with Daryl Hannah and it was okay. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't great, but and who is working the room, chatting people up? And Ron Howard comes over to my wife, Nancy, and I. He says, so you were at the screening, right? And we said, oh, yes. And he says, well, did you like it? Was it a good movie? And I thought, this is amazing. Then here, this director for Disney, for Buena Vista, Ron Howard, is coming over to theater owners asking them if they like it. So that's my hat into the ring as far as anecdotes go.
Oh, he knows that theater owners are important. But if I could just jump back to Orson Welles for a minute, and then I'll let them all go, because this has to do with Citizen Kane. Now, I don't know if Ian learned about this stuff in his course in that semester or what, but so Kane was made by Welles, and Welles had a non-interference contract with the studio. In other words, they couldn't touch a single frame of that film. But they tried, because they were getting a lot of pressure from William Randolph Hearst, right? Because, you know, he was trying to stop the movie because it was, you know, based on him. And he, you know, and the producers were nervous because they didn't, you know, upset him. And they were trying to, you know, make sure that there wasn't anything negative. So they would send spies to the studio while it was being but Welles got wind of it. And so whenever he saw people he didn't know, he would say, oh, that's not this movie. We're rehearsing something else.
Oh, okay.
But they weren't satisfied with that. They were trying to get Welles, someone tipped Welles that Hearst people were going to set him up, that when he went into his hotel room, there was going to be a naked woman that would jump out at him, and there'd be Hearst people there to photograph him, to try and, you know, destroy his reputation and hurt him.
Yeah.
When Welles heard this, he had a simple solution. He didn't go to his hotel that night. He slept somewhere else.
Good.
And of course, we know, you know, the film was made and became one of the, you know, greatest, most influential films of all time. But that's the kind of pressure, right, that, you know, directors can be under, that you're making the film, and that the people who believe that they're the subject of the film, maybe correctly so, are trying everything they can to stop you from making that film. And I'm sure that's the only case.
Well, that, I mean, I don't know if I've talked about this before on the show, but for the podcast, but they didn't stop there, because he obviously was not successful right away, but he was able to make the film and it was what he wanted. They didn't do anything, but he still had that three picture deal with RKO and he had to make three films. So he moved on to The Magnificent Ambersons, which is going to be the next film, the sophomore film. And they built all these elaborate sets. They cut out the floor so they can move this camera around 360 degrees, you know, like amazing stuff.
Yeah.
So he, you know, cut the film. And then for his third picture, all of a sudden RKA was like, you got to go down to South America and shoot this documentary. And you got to go down there. So when he went to South America to shoot this film, they recut Magnificent Ambersons and then burned the negative
He
could never recut. So that's how Hearst got back.
Oh, Jesus.
Wow.
Good and old William Randolph.
Magnificent Ambersons, people like that film, but it's not hailed.
I love it.
It's not hailed as like Citizen Kane. And it would have really catapulted him further and further than he was at that point, I guess, and made him more, a little more untouchable. So they kind of like really cut him off with the leg, with kind of ruining his second film.
Well, Magnificent Ambersons was part of the Elgin Play at the Death Festival.
Yeah,
he played that quite a few times, you know, with Citizen Kane, without.
Yeah, well, studio heads are notorious for screwing around with people. That film about Ian, you got to help me here. It's a Columbia release, I think, in the late 30s, early 40s. It was a beautiful film about Shangri-La or something like that. And Harry Kahn at Columbia saw it, and he says it's too damn long. He told the guy, because I guess they were using like a lavender print, you know, which is like an interpositive instead of the actual negative. But he said, I want you to drop those next to the last two reels. So he just arbitrarily cut 20 minutes out of the film because he thought it was too long.
You have a Lost Horizon?
Lost Horizon, yeah. And it's sad, you know, when filmmakers go, you know, with their heart and make something. I mean, Well, of course, there's other people that the guy that made the film that actually buried United Artists.
Michael Cimino?
Yeah, Michael Cimino, you know. That film that he made was so costly that it really did in United Artists for that period. That's when MGM bought them. And, you know, the other thing that we should bring up is that there's some people that work on volume too. And good old Alfred was that way. I mean, in terms of people that made films, the I think one of the few guys to top Alfred Hitchcock in the number of films made was Roger Corman. But Hitchcock supposedly made 53. And then some of the others that I had on the list were like Woody Allen with 50, Sidney Lumet, 43, Steven Soderbergh with 38, Clint Eastwood, 36, Altman and Spielberg tied at 35. So, you know, it's strange the way we look at directors. We look at their films, we love their films, we hate their films. And sometimes it's the volume of films. And like you were saying, Ian, you know, you have one director and you go, oh, I like those films, but oh, he made those too?
Yeah, you have a lot of those. And as a director, as an art form, you have your hits and your misses. I mean, there's no real director that's, you know, batted 1,000 in their films, except for maybe one. And that man is probably Charles Laughton, because he only made one film.
One
and it
film.
Was Night, and it was Night of the Hunter, which is fantastic.
I love it. Yeah.
Even Hitchcock, right?
Yeah, he had some flops. I mean, yeah. At the end, family
the
plot.
British Hitchcock did not do well.
Yeah.
But I think British Hitchcock is much better than the later Hitchcock, like family plot. But even Torn Curtain.
I didn't like.
But I think Torn Curtain would have been a completely different film if they had let him do the score with Bernard Herrmann.
Oh, yeah, I agree.
I was towards the end. They wanted to get rid of Herrmann. They thought he was too old school. And they basically made Hitchcock cut him out. And he actually did a whole score for the film. There actually supposedly is a score in the film by him.
Wow.
But then they cut him out and brought somebody else in. And I think I saw a scene of the knife scene when they're battling with the knife going back and forth.
Yeah.
With you know the two different soundtracks and obviously Herrmann's was so much better.
Yeah.
I was just talking to someone the other day, maybe it was Bernadette, I don't know, about the opening scene of The Birds.
Oh, sure.
And it's still clear in my mind, you know. It's just,
and it's clear in a lot of people's minds, because how many people do shtick about that, putting somebody in a phone booth and having, you know, dummy birds coming after the phone booth. I think they even did that one time on Saturday Night Live. You know, one of the things that I was wanting to bring up had to do with the whole World War II period and how, you know, we said the studios insinuate themselves into directors. Creative part, but when took power there, one of the films that I think it was a Lang movie called All Quiet on the Western Front, and 1930 movie, and Joseph Goebbels did everything he could, go into movie theaters, get the prints and destroy them, so we can understand the kind of propaganda that they were using in Nazi Germany. But I really think that some of the studios were quite complicit, because they were still allowing Nazi Germany to show some of the studio films in there that they thought they were okay, or they'd ask them to cut some scenes out. And the studios that really allowed that were MGM, Paramount, and Fox, even to the point that MGM bought bonds to refinance factories in Nazi Germany a month after Kristallnacht, because they wanted to get their money out of Germany. Whereas there was one guy, and these were all basically like first generation Jews that had come from Eastern Europe, but one of the guys that wouldn't stand for it was Jack Warner, and he wouldn't allow the Warner films to be played in Nazi Germany. And he grabbed one of my favorite directors to come over from Germany into his studio, and that's Billy Wilder, who to this day, I mean, I don't think anybody who's ever seen Some Like It Hot comes away without really laughing it and enjoying a good time, to the point now that I hear they're making a Broadway show out of it this season. So,
well, nobody's perfect.
No. So I just thought I'd throw that into the hopper, because the poor directors sometimes get a short shrift when it comes to studio heads.
Oh, yeah.
Two areas, and far be it for me, you know, I'm probably the most culture Luddite amongst us, but I must say that areas for the Directors Guild that were lacking were Black directors and women directors. And thank God, Catherine Bigelow was the first woman director ever to win an Academy Award, and it was for Hurt Locker, which I thought was a really good film.
Yeah, it's very intense.
You know, and then you got a young guy coming up, you know, wanted to make a movie. All he got was $175,000 to make it, and he did the right thing. And Spike Lee wound up making for that studio $7 million with that $175,000 film. And it's a great film. And, you know, it's there are not as many Black directors that I think could be in the business. What's his name? Ian will know. The guy, his first film that he directed for a studio, I think it was Columbia, Boys in the Hood.
John Singleton.
Singleton, yeah. Absolutely great film. Phenomenal film. And he died so young. It was really sad.
Yeah.
So.
No, he was. I mean, we talked about doing directors. I did some research and bounced around it to really, you know, compiled a list of favorites, greatest, you know, whatever. So, you know, it's just like Singleton was definitely on that list. The Hughes brothers, who did Menace to Society, you know, soon after Boys in the Hood, and, you know, it went on to do things like From Hell and other movies like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then that, you know, nowadays with you know, Ryan Coogler, who, you know, does the Black Panther films, yes, but, you know, Fruitvale Station, which was one of his first films, you know, very very good film, you know, writes a lot of his stuff also. But it's going back to female directors. I wanted to bring up Ida Lupino.
One of my favorites.
Her film noir, Hitchhiker, which was the first film noir film directed by a woman, or at least it was proclaimed to be.
Yep. And The Bigamist.
Yep.
She made The Bigamist, and she always used the hell is that guy's name, Edmund O'Brien, in her films. And
yeah,
and her husband Howard Duff, they had a studio out in Hollywood themselves called Four Star Productions, and they made a lot of television shows. She was a director of, oh, I don't know, like 80, 90 TV shows.
Yeah.
So
and it's funny, I didn't realize she kept acting throughout that whole time also.
Sure, yeah, sure. And then you could go from the sublime to the ridiculous in female directors, because somebody who my wife Nancy always adored, she loved watching on TV, Laverne and Shirley, and Penny Marshall,
yeah,
who actually, I think, turned into a decent director. I don't think people realize, you know, between... let's say, what was the first one she did? Jumpin' Jack Flash with Whoopi Goldberg. And then she did Big. And she did that thing about with Robin Williams about Awakenings, you know, with with De Niro. And of course, I'm not a baseball fan like you guys, but one of my favorites, League of Their Own. Tom Hanks saying, hey, no crying baseball. What do you know?
That's now a series on Amazon Prime.
Is it really? Oh, yeah, okay.
But it hasn't gotten good reviews, but I haven't seen it yet, so I can't say for it.
Yeah. So I mean, you have things that you know, and she left us too early too. So, but I'm glad that we got to see the films that she did direct, and even though she's well known for her Laverne and Shirley, it's nice that she put another notch on her belt.
Yeah.
What do you got on your dance card, Chuck?
I got to get to my dance squad. Again, it's not always great big time directors that have problems with studios, but I have this, what would seem to be an innocuous film, The 40-Year-Old Virgin.
Okay.
Judd Apatow.
Oh, Apatow. Yeah, he's a good director. Yeah.
He directed it. And he decided early on that Steve Carell would be perfect for the lead. At the time, he was relatively, you know, unknown.
Yeah.
That really put him on the map. So he loved Carell, and he was casting him. And he filmed a scene, one of the early scenes, where Carell's riding around on a bicycle wearing, you know, a bike helmet. And the studio saw that scene, and they flipped out. They were so upset because they thought that Carell looked like he was insane, that people would look at him as like a serial killer. That's what they saw in that scene.
Wow.
And they actually were going to, they had decided that, it's Universal again. They decided that was it. They were going to stop production of the film and drop it right there because of the response that they had. So,
wow.
So Apatow got a time to plead his case to save the film, and the studio eventually gave in. They also felt that in addition to Carell looking like a serial killer, that Rudd was too fat.
Oh, please. Jesus Christ.
So to get the film made, Rudd had to agree to go on a diet, and that the studio insisted that they bring in a special editor to work on the film that would report to them. And Apatow agreed. And Carell, like, was great in the scene that Apatow loved. I don't know if you're familiar with the film, but there's a speed dating scene where all the people are going.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he loved that thing. When the studio got involved, they wanted to cut that scene totally out of the film.
Jesus Christ.
So luckily, they were able to, you know, keep that in, and ended up making a lot of money for Universal.
Oh, yeah.
They do everything they can to stop the directors from killing the film. And yeah. Then goes on. So
success, yeah.
Yeah, they gave him two more movies after that.
Yeah.
Or three more.
You know, one of the things, and, you know, because, and of course I loved while we were playing this, you know, we used to pick up some of these movies, Chuck, from, you know, because he had sub-distribution rights in New York from Arnold Jacobs, AJ Films, and he had a lot of the old Warner stuff. And I loved when we could play that stuff. And one of my favorite Bette Davis films is Now Voyager, with Paul Henreid, you know, they sharing a cigarette together. What do we need the moon for when we have the stars? I mean, it was very romantic stuff. And there was a crazy Hungarian that was a contract director at Warner Brothers that to this day, I think, holds. Now, he's not credited on all of these, but he had been involved with directing for Warner Brothers 170 movies. And of course, Now Voyager also had their contract composer, Max Steiner. And I mean, people like Michael Curtiz, the director, is really not known except by like film buffs. You know, it's not like, not a name or like kids that work in musical theater would know, but the average person would never think an insightful and innovative director like Busby Berkeley, but he's a guy that made all of those movies with the rotating dancers and kind of like Irish shots and stuff like that. So, you know, we can't forget people like that.
Yeah, those are complicated productions that have to be shot correctly and whatever. And it takes a tremendous amount of, you know, craft and ability to do that. Where you go and people enjoy it, watch it, they're not thinking about it. They're just enjoying the spectacle, not necessarily how the spectacle gets made.
Exactly, exactly.
So I got one more anecdote of sorts.
Okay.
With the director. And this has to do with the filmmaker Robert Rodriguez, not to be confused with Roberto Rodriguez. But,
yeah.
and he was intent upon making his first film, El Mariachi. And he knew that, you know, he couldn't have a big crew and it had to cheat. So basically he was going to serve as a one-man crew. He was a director, producer, writer, cinematographer, and editor.
Oh, Jesus.
So because of his frugality, he brought the budget down to like $7,000, but all he was able to raise was $4,000. So to
shit.
Get the rest of the money, he volunteered at a lab and facility in Austin, Texas. And for 1 month, he had to take cholesterol-reducing drug while sealed in an isolated room. And to keep his mind going, he was writing the script for El Mariachi while he's in the room.
Oh, my God.
And after the trial concluded, I mean, the pharmaceutical company gave him the $3,000 he needed, allowing him to begin production of his first film. And the film was a success and launched his career or whatever. But to this day, he still bears the scars on his arm from dealing with those at the lab facility. So that's a commitment that a director makes to get their film.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they talk about giving blood for your project. Yeah. Oh, God. I have a question for Ian here, because he's the most recent that's dealt with film and class and in the business. Robert Wise, name ring a bell?
Yes.
I never realized that, you know, he was making films for almost 60 years. One of my favorite films, an old black and white film from the 40s, I didn't realize he directed, called Curse of the Cat People. Directed that. And then he had some sci-fi, so it was like The Day the Earth Stood Still, which came in as a successful sci-fi movie, made money. And then of all things, he comes and bounces back in the 60s and continues West Side Story, Sound of Music, Sand Pebbles, and then does the first movie of Star Trek. I mean, this guy was a Renaissance man.
But just to let you know, that first Star Trek is like hailed as one of the worst films ever.
Really? Oh, okay. I didn't see it, so I don't know.
I mean, only because it was basically just like, how do you make this television show into a movie? And then they kind of just were like, all right, here it is. There was no with Wrath of Khan and Search of Spock, those kind of hit their beat as far as the movies go.
Well, Chuck and I know what it's like to pick a dog and play it. You get empty audiences. So, we've been knocking stuff off here. What do you guys want to add in on these?
Well, I just want to talk about a director that I've always liked, you know, from the movies, because as a kid, when I got into the Marx Brothers, I just never really kind of looked into the rest of his career. And it's Leo McCarey. Known more for, you know, A Fair to Remember and The Affair, but yeah. You know, I love Duck Soup, The Awful Truth, or Awful Truth with Cary Grant and Irene Dunn. And then one of his last films, which I think I've talked about before on the show, is Rally Around the Flag Boys with Paul Newman. And
I haven't thought of that film in ages.
I love that film. But yeah, so he's definitely someone that I looked up today and kind of just did some research on, and it was like, wow, I didn't realize that he did all three of those films. He was in my head as far as when I was thinking of directors. I was like, Leo McCarey, I gotta have, you know, something. And I realized that he did all three of those films. That's why I've seen his name on those title cards at the beginning of the film.
And I think sometimes directors live in the shadow of someone either before them or, you know, and the reason I bring that up, because, you know, the Scott brothers directed commercials and then they came into the film business. And of course, Ridley was the guy that really just was blowing stuff out of the water, but his brother Tony did some decent films. I mean, he died early. He died, I think, 2010 or something like that. But he made one of my all-time favorite sick movies, starring David Bowie and Susan Sarandon, called Hunger. And if you ever want to see a twisted film, rent that one. Oh, that's, I mean, it's very powerful, very sensual, and visually, I guess because of him working on commercials, visually very powerful. And of course, then he did Top Gun, which we know what a hit that was. Yeah. And I never realized that he got a screenplay from a guy by the name of Quentin Tarantino, and he directed True Romance.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
I was going to say True Romance. That's my favorite Tony Scott film.
Yeah.
Hands down. Yeah. And he also did Crimson Tide.
That's right. Yeah.
Like, he always kind of hooked up with a certain actor for a while. Like, he did Tom Cruise in the 80s with Top Gun, and he did Days of Thunder. And then in the 90s and 2000s, he picked up Denzel Washington with Crimson Tide, then moved on to other things. You know, Deja Vu. Early 2000 films. His career definitely, he was filled with a lot of films. He made a lot of films.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it was brotherly love, and they weren't really having a pissing contest. But I know Ridley, because he's still alive and still making movies, probably is the one that's best remembered.
Yeah, I mean, he's just a machine. I mean, he basically, how he talks about film, where he's basically like, by the time I go in to shoot the film, I'm already on to the next one because I've already shot this movie in my head. So he goes and it's just such a quick and easy job to get through. That's why he makes so many films, because he can go through them in 60 days.
Well, that's that brings us back into the 30s. With somebody who is notorious that I believe MGM would use, W.S. Van Dyke, or Woody Van Dyke. And they used to call him One Take Woody, because he never wanted to spend movie money for of the movie studios on doing a second take. He was notorious for that.
I'd sort of throw in, because when you mentioned Robert Wise before, I realized that he was... filmmaker of one of my favorite films, Odds Against Tomorrow.
Oh, I don't know that one.
Harry Belafonte. But the reason that I was drawn particularly to that film at that time is that the score for the movie is done by the Modern Jazz Quartet.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And that an interesting film.
What's it called again?
Odds Against Tomorrow.
Okay.
With Harry Belafonte.
Okay.
And it's a good film with a fabulous score. So, but it was Wise was the director.
So what do you think, guys? You think we have whetted the appetite of our listeners with this? With what you and Ian were saying, I got to look in my Funkin' Wagnall for a few more films and directors. Should we... postponed for part two for the
what do you mean postpone part two?
No, I mean do a postpone
planning to do part two. Yeah, I don't want to postpone part two. I think we should do part two.
Yeah. So
let's do it right now.
Do it right now. So
that's the young guy saying that.
Yeah.
You can follow us on Twitter at Elgin Movie, on Instagram at Elgin Movie Watchers, on Facebook at Elgin Movie Watchers Podcast, and you can contact us anytime on email at elginmoviewatchers@gmail.com.
Sounds good to me, Chuck.
That's pretty good for part one.
Okay, all right.
There you go.
So I guess we're wrapped up for part one, okay?
See you next time.
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks. Take care, guys.
Take care. The boom,
Thank you.